Welcome back to the Expert Witness Playbook. I'm your host, Dr. Brian Woodruff, a pediatric neurologist and medical expert witness. On this podcast, we explore the intersection of medicine and the legal system and talk to physicians, attorneys, and industry leaders about how expert witness work really happens, from building an expert practice to understanding how cases are evaluated and litigated. Today's guest is Dr. Josh Russell. Josh Russell, MD, is an emergency medicine, urgent care, and palliative care physician with nearly a decade of malpractice expert experience. In addition to being a fellow native Michigander, Josh wears many hats, from working as an editor-in-chief for a medical journal to hosting a podcast to a medical director and C-suite executive roles with both health systems and vendors, and is an active health tech advisor, consultant, and investor. He joins us today to discuss his story as an expert and his strategic advisory work with Experitas. Experitas is a physician-led startup that reimagines the process of medical expert work through a human AI hybrid model, essentially leveraging the power of AI efficiency and combining it with human reliability, which yields much faster and more affordable case merit pre-screening for attorneys. And MedMal is just the tip of the iceberg. He sees a world where this technology can be used by any entity for evaluating whether clinicians' care is reasonable and appropriate. Medical boards, malpractice insurance carriers, credentialing committees, among other things. Josh, welcome to the podcast.
Brian, so good to be here. Thank you for the warm intro.
So we just got to start out. It's sort of mind blowing that we have so many connections. When we met a while back, we figured out that you have spent time in the little tiny town that I grew up in. And in fact, we're a substitute teacher at the little rural high school where I went to high school. Obviously, you're younger than me, so we made sure there wasn't an overlap that you weren't one of my teachers. But so tell us about your background. I think kind of what got you into medicine. What do you do within medicine? Because obviously, being a clinician is your primary work.
Yeah, I mean, I still identify as a clinician first. However, I would say that the minority of my time, if you look at any given week, is spent seeing patients anymore. And that's just because through the experiences that I've developed, which have been in a lot of different fields in and surrounding medicine, I have a mix of expertise that's allowed me to be involved in really cool projects. And one of them is this project that I'm working with some colleagues on called Experitas that we'll talk about. But I trained in emergency medicine. I always knew I wanted to be a doctor, and I didn't really know what I wanted to see. So emergency medicine seemed to be a good mix of that. And it allowed, through the at least the virtuous aspects of shift work, a lot of discretion over your schedule. And so I started to take on administrative and leadership roles, education roles, side hustles, as it were, pretty early in my clinical career after graduating residency, and things kind of snowballed, and here we are today. So I started working with Andy Barnett, Dr. Andy Barnett, who is much more accomplished MedMal expert, but I've worked with him on a number of cases. We were co-residents during residency, and he built his practice up over a number of years with a lot of investment on things you've talked about in your podcast before, like Seek. And he grew the book of business that he had to a point where the rate limiting ingredient was not cases coming in, but it was his time and his energy. And so we started getting at the core elements of what the expert is needed for and what things can be augmented or facilitated with these new tools that most people are starting to play with, hopefully. And that's where we are today, is figuring out that right balance of using AI to streamline things for experts, but also not taking the human out of the loop. And we talked before that the reality of MedMal work, unlike clinical work, is that there is no precedent or model where there's not an attorney and a human expert. So I don't think we have to worry about job security, but I think there is a lot of fat to be trimmed, as it were, in terms of how the very high paid and very expert brains working on cases can be used most efficiently.
So you have a fair amount of expert witness experience that you bring into all of this. You've reviewed cases, you've been in deposition and trial. There are a lot of people out there listening that may be just getting into being an expert. I always ask this of almost everybody that I have on the show is, what if you have to give two or three pieces of advice to somebody that's starting out, either what to do or what not to do, what would be a couple sort of things maybe you learned the hard way or not so much that will make it a little bit easier for those listening?
Well, one thing that you've alluded to before is, I think, approaching it with realistic expectations about the pace of which you're going to get cases and the pace of which cases are going to sort of progress, is that this is not a, you know, side hustle that you start and you start seeing paychecks immediately. And the more you put into it, the more you get out of it. But if you're expecting immediate results, I think it can be very disheartening. So I would try a lot of avenues, and then I would start finding people. LinkedIn is a great resource. You find people that are doing this kind of work and reach out to them and see if you can ask them questions, learn from their experience, how they came upon cases. And the more you start befriending people, there are a lot of cases that have come my way, especially from local attorneys where I'm conflicted. And I've had to look for people that I trust to make a warm handoff and referral for the attorney. So the more that you ingratiate yourself to people that are doing this work, you can learn from their experience. Also have them as a sounding board when you're in a conundrum, which I'm sure never happens to you, Brian, but occasionally I'm not sure what to say or what to do about a case.
Yeah, but for me, certainly.
So I would say those are the top things is you know, it's a lonely enterprise if you try to go it alone. And I think that you can get into a place very easily that is riddled with self-doubt, that you might not be doing the right thing, or that even on any individual case that you're not quite sure what the right answer is. And sometimes it's just helpful to have somebody affirm that it's, you know, a tough case and there's not always an easy answer.
You know, one thing that just kind of struck me is when you said it's sort of lonely. It's unusual to me that there isn't like an association of expert witnesses. It's sort of weird. I like where, you know, like neurology, peds neurology, what my field I'm in, emergency medicine, everything seems to have it's this one rare area, and I haven't been able to figure out why people don't get together to talk about their experiences. But it just they're. That just hasn't happened. Maybe there's a place for that out there for somebody to get experts together. You know, SEEK has conferences, but it's mostly educationally based. And there are other forensic expert witness groups, but they're very much trying to sell something, but more of the nonprofit get together.
Right. Absolutely.
So I mean, maybe that's another venture. I think another thing that,
absolutely.
I think we just maybe came up with something where we, not a money making, but more of a networking and connector, which could be pretty fun.
Yeah.
So we talked about as a clinician, emergency medicine, urgent care. You know, I've listened to some of your podcasts as it relates to various things, and learned a lot about sort of. I thought I knew about difference between emergency medicine and urgent care, and I didn't, you know, and it's, you know, it's, and some of the more nuanced things.
Well, you're not alone. So don't beat yourself up about that, because I think it's outside of working in urgent care, most emergency medicine doctors don't know the difference too.
And the fact that there's not really something defined, you know, urgent care versus minute clinic versus there's, you know, somebody that just stays open in the evening from the regular clinic and turns it into an urgent care. The subtleties of all of that. Well, I think I'm most excited to hear about more about some of your adventures into other things, especially Experitas, because AI, it feels like 6 months ago we weren't talking about AI at all. At least I wasn't. And I was in a coffee shop getting some work done about a week ago. And there was a conversation to the right of me. Somebody was talking about Claude and something related to AI. And they got up and left, and two people sat down to the left of me. And the first conversation they had was AI. It's like it's everywhere now. And it's coming. It's coming for every industry. I can't think of a single industry where there's not something that can be done. So let's just sort of talk about your experience with AI as it relates to Expert and some of the advisory work that you've done in that field.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I will say that I was a little bit ahead of you, but I mean, you can't be too much ahead of your sort of adoption of AI, because it's only been the last few years that it's been something that has been anything other than very early adopters and people in the tech industry who are even kind of aware. And I think a large language model now, LLMs, are sort of things that people understand what they are. And maybe a year and a half ago, I don't know that I could articulate what an LLM was. So it's been tremendously fast adoption. The pace of adoption of AI has outpaced cell phones, has outpaced the internet, has outpaced every piece of technology to date. So I realized that what you said was true. And I think it's because the opportunities for cost containment are so dramatic, and every business, you know, has to deal with the cost side of the equation. So if we can find tools that dramatically reduce our costs and increase our efficiency, then everybody wins in terms of that initial product. I mean, it's a different conversation about the human costs and the environmental costs of AI. So I'm not going to get into all of that. But the AI revolution or wave was apparent to me. And I realized that I was having a hard time trying to wrap my head around it, keep up with it without from the outside. So I started to look for opportunities, and I work with one company still today that does AI machine learning software for urgent cares predominantly, and that's a vast majority of the work that I do. And the work that I do with Expertos is sort of a corollary to that, but we are, instead of developing a clinical reasoning application, we're developing a med mal expert sort of reasoning that is to assess the standard of care. And as an expert, you are aware of this. The standard of care is not something you can look up in a book. The standard of care is an opinion of an expert. And so that is very contextually dependent. You probably have heard this term context before, as it's describing in LLMs, which is basically how much data can they keep in their head at one point and say, you know, an answer to a question while taking into account all of that data. And and the human brain is especially that of a well-trained and experienced expert is top-notch. And AI is not quite there yet, but there are a lot of the subtasks that get to the reasoning piece that AI is extremely helpful for, especially like case summarization. So in an effort to try to figure out how we could start to apply that AI in a way that would be verifiable, because attorneys are understandably pretty conservative about adopting new technology. It's quite costly, and just not financially so, but also not only financially, but also to their reputation if they're relying on tools where they're not confident that they're going to get the output that they want. So
even a 1% inaccuracy can cost, you know, a lot of problems, right? I mean, right. Even, you know, we talk about nothing can be perfect. Experts aren't perfect, but the AI has to be, it's got to be pretty accurate, probably more accurate than where we're at now, but it's going to get there.
You know, yeah, you're absolutely right. I mean, I don't know that any attorney would probably put a number on an acceptable miss rate that's below 1%. It's sort of, as emergency physicians, everyone's, you know, willing to do, let's talk about neurology since you're a neurologist, like do 100 CTAs, even if all 100 of them are going to be negative, to make sure they're not missing like one cervical artery dissection or acute stroke. So I think the same thing's true for attorneys, is that they're willing to do whatever it takes to not have that one miss, even if it's one in 100. So to that end, the acceptance criteria is really high for attorneys. And that has really precluded any AI tool from grabbing much market share. And I've talked to a lot of attorney clients that we've worked with, and they have shiny interfaces and nice UIs, but they miss the mark. And it's not 1% of the time. It's maybe 20, 30, 40% of the time, some of them. And it's not on the summary piece and not necessarily on the causation piece, but the standard of care is really hard. And we talked about this a little bit before, but I think it'd be worth kind of discussing why that phenomenon, at least one of the main reasons why that phenomenon exists.
Yeah, absolutely. And one of the things is that unlike medicine, standard of care is more legal, and that the exact definition can change also from state to state. It's like laws can change from state to state, but medicine doesn't. So like in cases, prior episodes, we talked about sort of the three pillars of what you give opinions on: standard of care, causation, damages. Well, causation and damages is the same whether I'm sitting in Lapeer, Michigan, where we grew up, or I'm in Denver, Colorado, or out in Portland, Oregon, where you are. But standard of care is not. And so maybe at some point you can kind of how you're incorporating in some of that possibly, or is that more kind of a nuanced for later?
No, I think it's all part of it. And there are ways in which you can look at development of machine learning and AI reasoning sort of analogous to the path that humans go through in training. And as you start medical school, you're very closely supervised. You're not allowed to do a lot. And as your training progresses and you demonstrate competencies, the training wheels come off and the reins are loosened. And the same thing is true for models, is the amount of human supervision that they need is really dependent on how they perform. And the way that they perform best is through correct training strategies. And that's a lot of like what our secret sauce is, but also that there is the correct data that they need to learn from. And what the problem is with ChatGPT or Gemini or Claude is that they have access only to the publicly available internet codex of information. So that includes, you know, plaintiff attorney blogs, stories that people post on social media and on their personal blogs, news articles. These are highly skewed towards events where there's negligence, malfeasance on the part of a hospital or a physician or nurse. And so there is a bias from the model as it is learning, in the same way that someone who might be not living in a place where that's portrayed as very violent. I mean, Portland, Oregon is one, because I live here, I know it's quite a tranquil place to live, but people who had seen it on the news in the last few years might think that there are like constant riots going on, which is not at all the case. And that's sort of what the large language models have as their perspective, is like if they had the entire, if you're having the entire opinion that you have about a place formed by what you see about that place on the news. So our pathway to building a model is largely predicated on the way that we are collecting patient data, real patient data, in a way that's HIPAA compliant and secure and de-identified, and using that data and also data where things don't go wrong to expose the model as it's learning to the entire spectrum of what can happen to people, both from a care standpoint and from a natural history of disease standpoint.
So you're teaching. That's got to be a huge investment. Obviously, setting it up is not. But what I've learned is teaching takes a tremendous amount of time and money to get that. So in an ideal, give me sort of an example of what you hope Asperitas is in its first commercial iteration, what you hope it's going to be able to do, what is it going to spit out, take in and spit out?
Yeah. So what we are doing already is using AI with human experts, specialty specific experts, to review case summaries, and the combination of different non-proprietary models. So these are commercially available models that we use in various combinations to create summaries. Then we send those summaries to a real expert through our platform. And we compensate that expert for the review. But instead of getting a huge stack of various types of documents and PDFs, they get a 3-page summary and they answer a few questions about their opinions about the standard of care being breached and how likely that was to be causal. And, you know, if there's anything that's missing, oftentimes there's something that would change your opinion or could change your opinion dramatically, and it's just not included in the records that are provided. So we need human experts who are specialized in the relevant specialty to opine, or I shouldn't say opine because it's not an opinion, but it's analysis is what we call it. The advantage to the experts is, first of all, like we talked about and you talk about on every episode of your podcast, is this is not necessarily an intuitively easy or straightforward path to getting expert work. So this offers an opportunity for people who are interested in this work to get involved where the stakes are relatively low. They're not identified in their analysis to the attorney. And they do have the opportunity, if they should so desire, to offer themselves up to be retained if that attorney should want to pursue the case further. So that is often, for some of our experts, even if they've been working in the field 20 years and have tried to do this a number of different times, their first actual opportunity to be retained. And it's a meritocracy rather than sort of an oligarchy. So the expert world, understandably, because the work is hard to come by, is a little bit, and maybe this gets to why there's not like a warm community, is I think it's a little bit competitive, maybe more than a little bit competitive, because there's more desire or more supply of experts than there is supply of cases. So what we try to do is allow for people to demonstrate their conscientiousness and ability to analyze cases through the platform, their responsiveness. As you know, very important as if you're an expert to be promptly responding to emails.
So important.
There's a sort of meritocracy that develops within this community of physician experts that we have. And while they are labeling these cases, we're getting compensated by the attorney for that, which is essentially a preliminary merit assessment. The experts are getting compensated, and then their feedback is going towards training the model. So we already are revenue generating company, but that revenue, the potential for it obviously goes up the less supervision the model needs down the road. But that's not a near term sort of reality. What we're doing right now is growing our brand and figuring out, frankly, what the plaintiff attorneys want. And the reason why I think there's an opportunity here is, even if you've done this for a while, it's not always super clear, like, what are the pressures and constraints and motivations for plaintiff's attorneys. Defense attorneys are different than plaintiff's attorneys. So you learn that sort of slowly as an expert, but we're learning it faster as an organization that's serving attorneys predominantly.
And it sounds like at first it's more of a looking at cases from the plaintiff side. Obviously, a case has to be filed, and before the defense even has a chance to look at it. So this is primarily starting out looking at standard of care from the plaintiff side, is what I'm hearing.
Yeah, and we do get some defense cases because there are times when defense attorneys want a second opinion. I think that's probably the most common use case for a defense attorney, is they have gotten an unfavorable response, as I'll call it, from one expert that there's, you know, potentially no defense. I've been one of those people sometimes that's been the expert that's had to tell somebody, I'm sorry, you have no real case here on either side, but specifically for the defense. And I've also been the second or even third expert that's been called or retained by a defense firm because of, you know, wanting to be able to really come back to their client and say, I think we need to settle this because there's nothing defensible about this.
And we've talked to three experts. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. They can't go back and say, we'll talk to somebody else. No, we've talked to three people. No, right. I think that's important.
Exactly.
So you guys have, experience really on both sides. You know, I know AI, I think, is going to start to impact, you know, insurance companies are always on the defense side, are always looking for ways to reduce cost, reduce expert cost. outside of, you know, you're looking at a model. There are probably lots of other AI avenues out there, from summarization to strategy to damages analysis. Are you guys working in any of those sort of arenas, or are you guys staying pretty tight within the, just looking at standard of care, and then just using some other models that summarize for you?
Yeah, that's a great question, and a common pitfall that small businesses succumb to, especially in early stages, is trying to do too much and losing focus on what they can do as a team. And our leadership is viewing really this plaintiff's work predominantly, but also, you know, defense work, but predominantly attorney work as a beachhead, as we call it. So this is our ability to establish a brand and trust among attorneys, develop some revenue so we can start having people hired, you know, as employees. And so that is an important first step. Everything that you mentioned is important also. And as the brand grows, features can be added to assess the adequacy of records, for example, to figure out ways to help facilitate obtaining the additional records. It's really getting to know the attorneys in this stage and what their pain points are. We've identified this as a pain point, and that there's ways to do a case analysis where it might take several weeks normally to get an expert to even do a preliminary review without a retainer and get them on the phone and talk to them about the case. And we can do that in 2-3 business days, and usually for 25 to 30% of the cost that most experts would charge for that service. So that is giving us an ability to...
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah. And it's honestly, I feel good about the work we're doing, because we're preventing frivolous lawsuits and overspending on things when a well-oiled machine with appropriate guardrails can actually make that assessment in a relatively short period of time with a quick human oversight process, instead of... you know, coordinating calendars and having to have a synchronized conversation. And then the attorneys are given the opportunity to have a referral for that expert if they should so choose. And that gives us another opportunity to generate some revenue so we can devote, like you said, to the resource intensive process of training the model so that it can be helpful for insurance companies and medical boards and anybody who's trying to assess the appropriateness of care for patients by clinicians of any kind.
Yeah, in medicine, we're always talking about people working to the top of their licensure, right? Physicians should do what physicians do well. Nurses do what nurses do well. And I have thought in the past that physicians organizing records and summarizing records and extracting the information out, both sides, both plaintiff and defense, spend a lot of money on that endeavor. And it, you know, it certainly is built in, and that's why experts tend to bill a lot of hours, and some can make a lot of money. But I think that some of these things is where AI is going to, like you said at the beginning, sort of cut some of the fat. But it's still going to take, you know, the legal system is still a judge, attorneys, experts, jury. There's still a lot of human in all of that, and it's such a, I would say, an intimate experience. It's that I think the AI is going to help with a lot of things, but I don't think people should worry that it's going to eliminate the humans. But if your job is just summarizing records and that's all you do, it may be a little concerning, because a lot of your time, there may be a place for people to, once it's summarized, to do some human verification. But I think if just summarizing, that's probably the next thing that's probably on the horizon. Probably one of the lower hanging pieces of fruit, wouldn't you think?
Yeah, there's a quote that I love that is probably broadly applicable to any professional domain where there are people that are doing clerical things still and getting paid for that, is that AI won't replace every individual, in this case, we'll say every expert, but it AI, experts who are comfortable with using AI tools appropriately and the right tools safely and in a way that protects the privacy that in ways that it needs to be protected are going to replace the experts who don't use these tools. So I think this is the time. There's because of the rate of adoption, it's probably much more limited, it's certainly much more limited than other new waves of technology, but this is the time to upskill and become familiar in my mind with these if you want to do the best you can to ensure your future survivability in the field.
Absolutely. One of the things I want to make sure and is how would somebody, if they want to get connected, how should somebody, you know, get connected with Asperitas?
Yeah, sure. Well, we have a website. It's just experitas.com, and it's E-X-P-E-R-I-T-A-S. If you have show notes, it'd be lovely if you could throw that in
we'll
there.
Yeah, we'll definitely, it'll be here at the bottom so that people can, so experitas.com.
Yeah,
and
sure.
On there, there's some sort of link where physicians can express their interest in being involved.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it just says expert sign up at the top right of the page on the landing page, and takes about 5 minutes to create a profile and give your relevant background in terms of your board certification, any work that you've done as an expert before. But we don't mandate that is something that you've done. We do review everyone's CV. And if you're a new resident grad, you're probably not going to be somebody who's going to be getting first dibs unless you're in a very niche field. But as the case count grows, there's going to be increasing opportunities to take these cases. And you mentioned the community of expert witnesses, and we actually hope to build something along those lines as we grow, because we are physician led. We're actually a company that I've invested in. The other founders have invested in, and we have attorneys that are investors, physicians that are investors, but we're not taking institutional capital for the reason because we want to be a physician-led company that's following our sensibilities about the right way to do this. And so one of the things that we want to, you know, have be an extension of what our ethos and sensibilities are is that a community forms of experts and, you know, to what extent we can provide resources. I don't know anyone who works at Seek. My mission here is not to seek and destroy Seek, but I would say that we don't charge experts anything ever. And we want to have an opportunity for people that are interested in this work and are conscientious and going to put in the time to review cases and give very thoughtful analyses. We want to give them an opportunity to participate and get connected. So that's on our long-term vision as part of what we're going to do is form a community that is this group of experts that are, you know, working together to figure out how to continue being experts in the world of the future.
Yeah, I think it's, I feel like we're just getting started with a conversation. We will, I'll certainly want to have you back in the future to kind of continue and for you to give us the update of how things are going. And you know, your perspective, you've got your finger on the pulse of AI at this point, obviously. And so many of us, you know, are not as close to it, and we want to learn. And I've already learned a lot today. I want to continue to learn, and that's one of the reasons for this podcast is I'm learning as much as sort of transmitting this information out. And so it's really good. I'm glad we had a chance to meet up today, because this has been a great conversation. I really appreciate you sharing both your perspective as a practicing physician expert and what you're building with Asperitas. I hope people will reach out to your company and get involved. I think it's exciting to think about how technology and physician expertise might reshape the way medical cases are evaluated in the future. Any last parting words? Anything else you want to throw out there to either experienced experts about AI or new experts about getting involved or anything else?
I would just say that this is an opportunity to lean in on that growth mindset and learning as part of a lifelong endeavor. And largely what I follow is because I'm learning every day as well. So I can appreciate that we're kindred spirits apart from, you know, being from the same area of Michigan in that regard. And I'm happy to continue the conversation. You can find me on LinkedIn. It's just Joshua Russell, MD after LinkedIn. I think there's some hyphens in there. Or Josh Russell, MD, all one word, .com, or the Focused Exam MD, or the Focused Exam.com. So that's my personal website if you wanted to talk to me about consulting or anything along the lines of learning more about this. But, you know, I'm up for any conversation. So I'm looking forward to being back on the podcast. And I wish you luck with this endeavor. We need podcasts in this space. And, you know, the expert community is grateful for you.
Thanks. And Josh, thanks again for joining us on the Expert Witness Playbook. And to our listeners, if you enjoyed this episode, please subscribe, share it with a colleague interested in expert witness work, and leave us a review. It really helps others to find the show. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next time on the Expert Witness Playbook.